Since 1775, generations of Americans have fought for our ideals and our principles. American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America. They fought to end slavery. They joined with allies to win two world wars. They have responded with valor and honor whenever called. And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world. Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen, soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun at Lexington and Concord. Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces. The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged. This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose. The American Warrior is on the air.
Don, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here for another great episode of American Warrior. Let's start with some military history, as we usually do. If we forget our history, we're bound to repeat it. On October 9th, this week, 1781, the bombardment of British forces at Yorktown began. The British started things off with their frigate, the HMS, or the French guns, opened the barrage and drove the British frigate HMS Guadalupe across the York River, where she was scuttled. At 5 p.m., the Americans opened fire. Now, the legend has it that George Washington fired the first gun and that the round from his gun smashed into a table where the British officers were eating. The Lockheed SR-71 Blackbird was developed as a long-range, high-speed reconnaissance aircraft. Built by Lockheed Martin and under a black operation they nicknamed the Skunk Works, it was designed to fly higher and faster than any threats. If a surface-to-air missile launch was detected, the standard evasive action was simply to accelerate and outfly the missile. The SR-71 served with the United States Air Force from 1964 to 1998. A total of 32 aircraft were built, 12 were lost in accidents, but none were ever shot down. This week, in 1999, the Blackbird, the SR-71, made her final flight. He grew up on a farm outside of Chatham, Louisiana, in a small home lit by kerosene lamps. A battery-operated radio powered by a wind generator provided his family with news and entertainment. Two or three times a week, the Iceman would deliver chunks of ice for their icebox, and a garden provided fresh food and canning, stored plenty of additional food for an entire year. He lived a simple farm life and early on learned important lessons. Among those, most importantly, he came to learn how things worked. In 1940, the Army conducted a training exercise near his home, including air support from P-40 aircraft. The sweet sound of those P-40 engines got him hooked for life and would lead to a life of flying. American Warrior is very proud to welcome another one of our Friday Pilot series to the studio. Today, we welcome Wilbur Pete Carpenter, a member of the Friday Pilots group. Pete, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thank you, sir.
Wow. Okay, so let me just tell us about the Friday Pilots. For our listeners who haven't heard before, tell us about the group and about your book.
Well, I've been a member for approximately 4 years now. It originally started with several of the guys showing up for lunch called the Luncho Buncho, and eventually it grew a little bit. Of course, some of the people have since passed away and aren't around. I joined as a member with one of my friends that invited me, and with all of the things that occurred in my life during that period of time. And we had several generals. There are a total of seven, 4-star down through 1-star. We have one astronaut, and we have three very important people to us who were POWs during the Vietnam exercise. It's an amazing group to sit around. It's all a matter of we know each other because of our business, not because of anything else, really. We discuss things just like everybody else does every Friday.
Right.
We
right.
normally have 12 to up to 20. Normally, we only have 20 or had 20 at the time our book was written. And, of course, they're not all available immediately. They go home or go out of town for the cold weather period in Tucson.
Yeah.
And then they come back. Yeah. And, of course, we've become a very, very close-knit group of people. And as the book was developed by Don Shepherd, General Shepherd, asked us one day, how would we like to participate in writing a book? And everybody's eyes lit up, of course. So what do you mean, write a book? Well, each of you will write a chapter, 10 to 15 pages long, and we'll put it in a book, and then we'll try to see if we can peddle it so that we can get some money for the Warriors. And that's the way it it began. Each of us submitted our paperwork, and he and his wife and friends did all of the editing and bringing it up to readable.
Well, yeah, and he's General Shepherd has written at least two or three other books, so he brought that experience to the table.
That's that's very correct. As a matter of fact, a couple of them from the Vietnam area era that took into consideration the type missions and whatnot that they were flying.
And folks, the name of the book is The Friday Pilots. You can buy it on Amazon. If you just Google The Friday Pilots, again, the book is The Friday Pilots. Pete, we're coming up on our first commercial break, but let's go back real quick to, cause I love your story of growing up, and I think particularly for the younger generation out there, you know, they don't maybe recognize, I mean, literally kerosene lamps, no electricity till later now, but it wasn't uphill both ways all the time. Your family did have the very first electric refrigerator in town, correct?
That's correct.
And how big was it?
6 cubic feet. We thought it was a giant.
That's what, like an ice chest, right? I mean.
Well, it didn't hold an awful lot, and it wasn't very cool. So it lasted for us for about 6 months, I guess, and my dad decided, hey, we'll get an 8 cubic foot. Someone else wanted to buy our 6 cubic foot.
Wow. So trading up.
Trading up.
Now, you, the Army exhibition or the exercise that you talked about in your book, was that the first time? That wasn't your first experience with aircraft, right? I mean, you were fascinated by airplanes before that.
Oh, I was definitely impressed with airplanes before that. I had a brother that was taking flying lessons. He was not real old, but he was a couple of years older than I, about 10 years, as a matter of fact. And that had always been mine. Every time an airplane flew over, regardless of what shape it was, I wanted to be in it.
Okay.
And, of course, the exercise that went on with the P-40s flying, buzzing the troops and whatnot really impressed me. I said, that's what I want to do. This was before the war.
Exactly. And we're going to talk about that when we come back in the first break. Folks, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined in studio by Pete Carpenter, U.S. Air Force Colonel retired, a member of the Friday Pilots. We'll be right back.
This is Ben Bueller Garcia, host of American Warrior Radio. If you're Medicare eligible and military connected, Rich Lewis and Medicare Mentors will guide you through setting up coverage and making sure you have the right options. You don't have to navigate the Medicare maze alone. Call Medicare Mentors now for your free consultation and free service. Call 719-886-3377. That's 719-886-3377. Medicare Mentors, personal guidance, no-cost consultation, proud sponsors of American Warrior Radio, Saturdays at noon on KPPF, Colorado Springs.
Life is full of bittersweet transitions. It's difficult to know how these changes will impact us over time. For some people, difficult transitions like retirement, divorce, or loss of a loved one can hit harder than expected and may contribute to feelings of hopelessness or even thoughts of suicide. The risk of suicide is even higher for men over 50 who served our country. Guys like me. That's why support from friends and family makes such a big difference. Every day, your actions could help save a life. Together, we got this. Learn how you can help save a life at VeteransCrisisLine.net.
I didn't want to talk. She just sat with me. That was all I really needed.
We got back. One day, he called me out of the blue. And it's comforting to know that I always can count on him to have my back.
She called me from time to time. I really didn't think I needed any help.
It took me from being really depressed to feeling like somebody cared to give me some hope. Just that one text. Be there. Your call, your presence, your words, your support. Be there and help save a life. Learn more about preventing suicide at veteranscrisisline.net.
Flag season is coming up. Like me, you want to fly the best flag to show your pride. That's why our house proudly flies a flag from Allegiance Flag Supply. American flags should be made in America, and Allegiance uses only the highest quality U.S. source materials sewn right here in the USA. Order your new flag for Memorial Day, Flag Day, and 4th of July today by visiting showallegiance.com. Use discount code AmericanWarrior at checkout for a 10% discount. The gold standard of flags for serious patriots. It's what we fly. Show Allegiance.
Powerful talk.
I like to talk about one thing that may be difficult about deployments, breaking the news to kids.
Powerful talk.
So, what is stress? How does stress affect us?
Powerful talk.
I think it's really important for us to ensure that the whole story is told and understand, you know, everyone's place in that historical context.
Knowledge is power. Get yours on KPPF.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here in American Warrior. I'm joined in the studio by Pete Carpenter. Pete is United States Air Force retired, a member of the Friday Pilots Group. I'd encourage you to Google Friday Pilots, get a copy of their book. It's just really a great read. There are 20 pilots that have written little short stories about their time in the military, and a great read. And we brought Pete in particular because the depth of your the depth of your experience, Pete. Now, we were talking before the break, like many of the people of your generation, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, everything changed. You had a brother that was in the Navy or was on board the USS Tennessee, which was moored right next to the USS Arizona during the attack, correct?
That's correct. He was at an angle behind it, inboard of the Arizona position.
And I tell you, one thing that, as someone who reads quite a bit of history, particularly World War II history, I've thought often about communication between those that served and their families back home, and just how long a message took. You know, you'd write a letter, maybe you'd see it not. And, you know, nowadays, God bless them, they're on Skype. They can see their family, emails instantaneous. But what really struck me about your book was the when you wrote that a while after the attack on Pearl Harbor, your family received a single postcard with a box checked. And what did the box say?
I'm okay.
And that's it. That's the way you knew your brother was. That's the first word you got that your brother was okay.
About 2 weeks.
Wow. That was actually pretty good, considering.
Well, the government had to purchase all those cards and pass them out to all the guys, you know. And there was a lot to be done in the harbor during that period of time.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, my brother indicated it took them about 7 days to blast their way out from behind the other ship that had sunk outboard of them.
Oh, my gosh. Well, and that's it's important that young people hear that. One other thing I'd like to share before we really get into your flight story, something else I thought was really interesting. During that period of time, so your other two brothers joined up, went off to war. You're left behind. How old were you at the time? Were you 17?
Well, at the time of the war, when it started, I was only, 11 years old.
Okay.
And I recall specifically we were visiting my grandmother, and there was not even a radio in the house. We were listening to it on the car radio when it came in, and, of course, everybody bloomed up. My first words were to my brother, who was a pilot at the time, light aircraft. Let's rent an airplane and get some hand grenades, and you and I fly to Japan and take care of it and burn those paper houses down.
There you go. That very, very good response. Now, you also, so you're left at home. You've got a truck. You've got the tractors. But I also found it really interesting. You talked about back in those days, you know, fuel was rationed during the war. But in those days, there were the old mechanical pumps. And you and your buddy would sneak out in the middle of the night and just kind of drain what was left over out of the hose. Again, so you put gas in your truck one cup at a time, huh?
Well, it wasn't a truck, really. It was a 1929 Ford Model A that had been kind of fixed up. It had slightly different tires on it than the original. Belonged to my older brother, who went into the service, and he left it at our house, so I got to drive it sometimes unintentionally, of course, but gas was rationed. We had a tank for farm fuel, and my dad says, I don't want to ever see you taking fuel out of that tank and putting in that car.
Mm-hmm.
Because farm fuel was not rationed.
Right.
So my alternative to that was to drain the pumps at night after the station closed.
And I think the statute of limitations probably passed on that. You're probably okay there, Pete. Now, you eventually did. You got old enough. You went down and signed up to fly. And your first solo flight was in a T-6 Texan. And that's kind of an interesting story because it was maybe a little bit earlier than you expected, correct?
Well, it was a lot different than I anticipated because I didn't expect to get put in the front seat of it and taxi out. And the guy says, okay, let's take off. And I did, like all of the other guys did. It was absolutely amazing. He kind of guided me a little bit, but that was my first flight. And from there on, it was all... Well, a lot of it was
almost
uphill, but I had a lot of fun and a lot of good friends. We were very close going through our flying school class.
You also relate a story in the Friday Pilots book that I found interesting but still a little bit sad, and it was about a French cadet that was in your class, and you called it Great Flight, Bad Finish. Explain to our listeners what this cadet did.
Well, he had gotten washed out, but he was a very patriotic French guy. I had known him. I didn't know him well, but I knew him. And we had taken a Christmas break, I guess, and come back right after New Year. And this one, we were down at noontime lining up to go to the flight line because we had schools in the morning, classes in the morning, and then we would go fly or vice versa. As we were lining up at Randolph, or the way it is set up, there's three or four buildings there, but they're three stories high. This T-6 comes screaming down. He's below the rooftop between two of the buildings, pulls up over the third building, and he's got the canopy open and waving, and sort of, what in the world is going on? And shortly thereafter, we received a relayed telephone call that we were not to go any place, to stay there. And we eventually started getting word that he was flying around. Other pilots tried to chase him and get him to land, and he evaded them. Eventually, he had gone over to other air bases and buzzed the towers and one thing and another, and headed out toward the Austin area, as I recall, and ran out of gas about 30, 40 miles out, and instead of trying to land it by any means, he pushed it over and dove into the ground and killed himself. That's how sincere he was about not being able to continue in the aviation cadet program.
Well, and that passion, I guess that's the good that I would take from that story is just the passion that not only serving your country and patriotism inspires, but the passion and just the joy that flight inspires, as it did in you. I mean, from those first visions of aircraft, you know, going over the farm or buzzing those troops, I mean, you fell in love.
Oh, yes. I think anybody that has any desire to fly and sees an airplane forever thereafter, an airplane noise comes by, you look to see it. I still do. I'm 86 years old, and I still look up to see airplanes. Sometimes they're a little far away, and I don't get a good view.
Well, and actually, I'm going to read a poem to you, and I had to look this up because when I read it in your book, I thought, you know, if this, well, and let me just read it for the listeners. Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter-silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds and done 100 things you have not dreamed of. Wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence, hovering there I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager aircraft through footless halls of air. Up, up the long, delirious, burning blue, I've topped the windswept heights with easy grace, where never lark or even eagle flew. And while with silent lifting mind I've trod the high, untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God. That's a poem called High Flight that was written by John Gillespie McGee, who is an American pilot who served in the Canadian Air Force during the Second World War. And you referenced that poem when you talked about your very first flight in a jet-powered aircraft. And that was as a T-80?
An F-80, P-80.
F-80, okay.
It was the first operational Air Force jet that was really produced in any numbers. I flew it at Williams Air Force Base, and of course then proceeded to Nellis Air Force Base in Nevada to Korea.
Okay. And I really love the fact that you, in the book, you say when you first took off and got airborne in that jet, your first thought was, what the heck am I doing here? But then the exhilaration and the love came back to fore, correct?
Well, it really happened when I pulled out on the runway. We had to run the aircraft up to 100% RPM to check all the gauges, and we had a little checklist we went by and wrote down the numbers and that sort of thing. And the brakes were at that power setting were very weak, and my legs are shaking, and along with the hey, I'm going to take off here in a minute. And I looked up and I said, what am I doing here?
You're riding a rocket. That's what you're doing.
I released the brakes, and from brake release on, it was pure fun. Great time, beautiful flight, and that's the word that came mm-hmm. from it. This poem that you read was included as a front page in our book at the end of our cadet career. Mm-hmm. And it was written in honor of a young man that was killed during that period of time.
Well, and as I understand, also words from that poem, grace, I don't know if grace is the right word, but adorn the headstones of many of the pilots buried at Arlington as well.
That is correct. And it is well known throughout the flying community, even civilian flying community. As a matter of fact, I had a nephew that was killed several years ago now, and I read it at his funeral.
Wow. Okay, well, those are powerful words. I'm glad I discovered it thanks to your book. Now, I tell you, we're about a minute from the next break. Pete, when we come back, I'd like to request you're on your way to Korea to fight the war in Korea as a pilot. Interesting thing happened on the way to Okinawa, though. And I thought that's another one. I loved your story in the book was just so filled of humorous anecdotes in a very dangerous business. So I want you to tell the listeners about your time as the provost marshal on board ship. And then I want to talk about you always wanted to fly a World War II aircraft and you got your chance. So we're going to tell the listeners about that. Folks, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined live in studio by Pete Carpenter, one of the Friday pilots. We'll be right back after these messages.
Standing at attention for our veterans, first responders, teachers, doctors, and nurses. We salute you for all you do.
I just want to thank you for doing what you're doing.
KPPF, the power of community.
Opportunities present themselves every day. Opportunities that move us forward. Opportunities to serve part-time in your community while continuing their full-time careers or education to help keep our nation safe at home and around the globe. Explore your opportunities in the Air Force Reserve.
This is Ben Bueller Garcia, host of American Warrior Radio. If you're Medicare eligible and military connected, Rich Lewis and Medicare Mentors will guide you through setting up coverage and making sure you have the right options. You don't have to navigate the Medicare maze alone. Call Medicare Mentors now for your free consultation and free service. Call 719-886-3377. That's 719-886-3377. Medicare Mentors, personal guidance, no cost consultation, proud sponsors of American Warrior Radio, Saturdays at noon on KPPF, Colorado Springs.
I didn't want to talk. She just sat with me. That was all I really needed.
We got back. One day he called me out of the blue, and it's comforting to know that I always can count on him to have my back.
She called me from time to time. I really didn't think I needed any help.
It took me from being really depressed to feeling like somebody cared to give me some hope. Just that one text
Be there. Your call, your presence, your words, your support. Be there and help save a life. Learn more about preventing suicide at veteranscrisisline.net.
We're building a radio station that is unique and different.
I like the news. I like being informed.
Stay with us at 98.5 FM, 1040 AM, and 95.7 FM KPPF, and hear the power of information.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior. I'm joined in studio by Pete Carpenter, who is a member of the Friday Pilots. This is a group of pilots that lunches once a week. They wrote a book about their experiences and adventures called The Friday Pilots. You can get that on Amazon.com, and $5 of the sale of each book goes to benefit the Fisher House. Now, Pete, coming back, there's, like I said before, a lot of great stories in your section of the book. One of my favorites was about an incident that occurred when you were being shipped over to Korea. You're on a, for all practical purposes, a troop transport, a big boat. But it was interesting that they had the wives and the families along on the ship as well, correct?
That's correct.
And as an officer, you're what, a lieutenant at the time?
Yes, sir. Second lieutenant.
Okay. Well, so you're barely a lieutenant. but so you guys are all given duty, and you were given probably the most important duty on the ship, and you ended up getting, did you get a medal for protecting the peanuts or what? tell our, I just thought that's such a cute story. Tell us what the provost marshal on the ship did or was done.
Well, I would have to back up a little bit on the story that you're telling, because we went on board and they gave us a set of orders and it had all the duties that we were supposed to have. Well, being in the Air Force, I had no idea what that job was. Provost Marshal, who is he? What he? And it turns out it's like our security police, or air police, as we knew them at that time. And it was kind of keeping things in order. You didn't really have any power, but I reported whatever to the senior officer, who was an Army guy. During that period of time, of course, it was not a bad boat. I had, I shouldn't call it a boat. It was a ship.
Exactly. Yeah, the USS Tucson guys would get a little upset by that. But okay.
And actually, it had staterooms with two each in the staterooms on the upper decks. And I believe there were 13 wives and families on board. And we had lunch served in a dining room. There was a place to move around. Down below, we had about 1,500 guys we took. And initially, we went to Hawaii, refueled, and we were there overnight for 24 hours. You won't believe it. Every guy was back on the boat, our ship, ready to go when we left. And that was part of our responsibility, of course, as a provost marshal. After we left there, of course, we had to do some things during the day, so we had card games and whatnot with the guys. I'm not much of a card player, but we were having this little game, and I had a can of potato chips, and I was eating those. And a little boy, one of the family members, came over. He was about 4 years old, and he looked at me, and he looked at my potatoes, and I says, go ahead and take some. So he grabs a handful, and he looks up at me, and he grabs another handful. And I look at him, he puts one of them down and hits me in my eye with his fist. And I literally got a black eye from that. I didn't know what to do at that point. Of course, the lady had, I think she had five children. So she was a little upset with him, but she had to look after those other four.
So maybe he thought you were going to exceed your authority as, or exercise your authority as provost marshal to enforce the one fistful of chips rule, I guess, on board.
I'm sorry?
So there's not one fistful of chips rule on board, maybe? Is that?
No.
Now, did you get a medal for that?
Not quite.
Okay.
The only medal I got was a black eye.
Now, tell us a little bit about Korea, if you would. You flew 100 missions in Korea, principally ground attack missions. For our civilian listeners, describe to them. I tell you what's surprising, Pete, is you were flying multiple missions per day. I mean, basically the aircraft would come in, they'd refuel it, somebody else would get in and take off again, or you might take the same bird up again?
You might take the same aircraft again. When we talk about air to ground, there's more than one aspect of that. Of course, you can either be close support for the troops or fixes, guns, most anything. A great deal of the effort at our time in Korea was oriented to close support when it was needed, or interdiction, which was to the north up as far as the Yalu. And my first missions were a little bit closer to the lower part. But we were after the bridges, the trains, and the railroad tracks to prevent supplies coming down out of China into the area where they could be used against the troops on the line.
And what kind of aircraft were you flying at the time?
I was flying the F-80, the same. It was a different model. It was a C model that we flew going through flying school at Williams.
Now, you also served during the Vietnam War. I'm curious, you know, in here, Vietnam, you hear a lot about places we could bomb, places we couldn't bomb, places we weren't supposed to be, places we were. In Korea, was pretty much every target was an available target if it was selected, or were there no-go zones in Korea as well?
There were some changes, there were rules, I should say. Mm-hmm. There, you don't press at the wrong place. One of the rules was that you don't get in a gunfight with a gun position on the ground with your guns.
Okay.
Except under very unusual circumstances, because you're going to get more lead coming up at you than you've got going toward them, and they can certainly see you further.
And you got a personal taste of that on a mission, on one mission, didn't you?
Yes, I was. Wasn't really against gun possession, but, you know, anytime somebody shoots at you, there's a chance of hitting. And it only takes one bullet. It doesn't matter how big the airplane. If it's in the right place, you've had it.
Oh, okay.
I think I was trying to remember. I think I had 15 impacts from the ground on that particular mission, and entered the wingtip. Broke the aileron brackets, and from there on out through the tail section from about 2 feet behind the cockpit. How they missed the fuel tank, I will never know.
Mm.
I didn't even know I had been hit. I got back on the ground and was filled out the forms and started to walk away, and my crew chief, who was a real sharp sergeant, I started to walk away, and he says, Colonel, Lieutenant,
yeah,
come back. You've got to fill out this paperwork, for you've got a bunch of bullet holes through my airplane.
And that you know, that tradition carries over today. It's their airplane, right, not yours?
Well, yes, because they work on the airplane. They're responsible for keeping it, and they accept that responsibility. We would go down and help them. I've polished my airplane with him. Mm-hmm. I've helped him with other things. Write-ups that made the airplane a better airplane. But he was your man.
Sure, sure. Now, I tell you, I'm kind of jumping all over the place, Pete, but I just love the stories you told in your chapter of the book. We've got about 2.5 minutes for the next commercial. Can you do the P-47 story in 2 minutes?
I probably can. It didn't take that long to do it.
Okay, I love the P-47. It was an ugly, ugly aircraft, but it was a beautiful aircraft at the same time. You always wanted to fly a World War II aircraft, and you got your chance. Tell us how that lovely but short flight turned out for you.
Well, it was actually a very short flight. The lead into it was probably the most complicated part, looking back on it. But I was too young to understand that I needed a little more guidance than I got. Going out to the airplane with the instructor that was going to give me my first flight. There were no two-seat versions, so we're going to go in one. Earlier in the day, I had gone in, had to fill out the paperwork, and the guy says, hey, you got to get a backseat ride in a T6 so you know how it feels to be in the B-47. We did that, came back in, and it was time to go. So we walked out of the airplane. The instructor came to my aircraft. By the way, these airplanes were like new airplanes because they had been built at the end of the war. In some cases, they had been sitting for several years, okay? So, and it had been redone. Now it was being ferried to one of the South American countries. A lot of people didn't understand that as well, that we were taking airplanes down through Cuba to some Dominican Republic, some of the other places. And we'd lost a couple of airplanes there. Anyway, I got in the airplane. He helped me start it. I would never have, it's a different airplane, okay? And we taxied out and did our run up and started pulling on the active, and he says, my canopy won't close, taxi back. We taxied back. He shut down, I shut down, and went over to his airplane, and I finally got it fixed. And he says, okay, let's go. He's still in his airplane. I go back over. The crew chief helps me get the airplane started. We taxi out and pull up to the runway, and he says, okay, you're ready. You're clear to go. I take off, and then he takes off. I release the brakes and rolling down the runway, and I start to lift off, and all of a sudden it feels rather odd, and it's drifting to the left, so I'm using right rudder, except at the time I didn't know I wasn't getting any right rudder. Got airborne, the right wheel later, dropped back down, hit the ground. I went airborne again. By this time, I'm drifting off the runway. The left wheel hits, back on the right wheel collapses, airplane spins, and engine comes off, catches on fire, slides to a stop. The problem was there was a control lock by the stick that was supposed to lock all four movements of the controls, okay? Unfortunately, it did not engage all of this until I reached a certain point where the rudders moving at the right rate, and it locked the rudders. That's the other controls were still okay.
Pretty tough to fly an aircraft with no rudder.
That kind of an aircraft, yes.
And when you're sitting there, you get out of the aircraft, thank goodness, it's on fire. Again, one of my favorite quotes of the books. Other folks roll up, they take a look at the burning plane, you're standing there, and they say, hey, what happened to the pilot, and what did you say?
Well, I had trouble getting out of the airplane because the canopy wouldn't come off. I knocked it off completely clear. I got out, went out beside the airplane, disgusted, took my chute off and all the other stuff, walked around on the other side. I'm about 100 yards or so from the terminal at Amarillo, Texas, and all of these people are pouring out on the field. He comes running up to me and says, did the pilot get out? And I said, I don't know. I just got here.
I don't know. I just got here. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Great stuff from Pete Carpenter. We'll be right back.
This is Ben Bueller Garcia, host of American Warrior Radio. If you're Medicare eligible and military connected, Rich Lewis and Medicare Mentors will guide you through setting up coverage and making sure you have the right options. You don't have to navigate the Medicare maze alone. Call Medicare Mentors now for your free consultation and free service. Call 719-886-3377. That's 719-886-3377. Medicare Mentors, personal guidance, no cost consultation, proud sponsors of American Warrior Radio, Saturdays at noon on KPPF Colorado Springs.
It's been called shell shock, war neurosis, and battle fatigue. Today, we call it post-traumatic stress disorder, and it affects one out of every five warriors returning from battle in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Wounded Warrior Project offers comfort and support for warriors with PTSD and all other scars of war, whether those scars are visible or hidden. Find out how to help, because for warriors, the greatest casualty is being forgotten. Please visit WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Flag season is coming up. Like me, you want to fly the best flag to show your pride. That's why our house proudly flies a flag from Allegiance Flag Supply. American flags should be made in America, and Allegiance uses only the highest quality U.S. source materials sewn right here in the USA. Order your new flag for Memorial Day, Flag Day, and 4th of July today by visiting showallegiance.com. Use discount code AmericanWarrior checkout for a 10% discount. The gold standard of flags for serious patrons. Patriots. It's what we fly. ShowAllegiance.com.
National Guard and Reserve members need their employer's support, both on duty and in the workplace. But where can employers go when they need advice? Employer support of the Guard and Reserve, ESGR, is here for you. We help businesses recruit, hire, and support service member employees. It's good for America and good for your workforce. Find your local ESGR representative at esgr.mil.
Hi, this is Craig Morgan. During this crisis, homeless veterans are alone, often sleeping on nothing more than a piece of cardboard. We need to act now. You have the power to move them from cardboard to headboard. Every dollar donated to Veterans Matters moves a homeless hero from the streets into their own home. To help, visit cardboardtoheadboard.org. They are not alone. They have you.
We are standing at attention for our veterans, first responders, teachers, doctors, and nurses. We salute you for all you do.
I just want to thank you for doing what you're doing.
KPPF, the power of community.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the...
Now, back to the American Warrior.
And we lit up
your... Welcome back, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, joined on American Warrior today by Pete Carpenter, one of the Friday pilots. Pete's got a lot of great stories in his book, The Friday Pilots. We're not going to, well, he's one of the authors of the book, The Friday Pilots. There's 20 of them that have put their anecdotes in this book. We're not going to have time to get to everything, but Pete, in the previous segment, I asked you a question specifically about Korea and if there were things that are off, off limits or weren't. And I specifically mentioned that because you also served in Vietnam. And when I asked that about you, I could tell the fire flare up in your eyes. That was Vietnam was a different rules of engagement, I guess would maybe the nice way to put it, huh?
That would be a very nice way of putting it. They changed daily. Some areas you were not permitted to go into one time. The next day, it might be open. This was particularly true up around the Hanoi area and in North Vietnam against certain targets. But it was also true in other areas as well. Very demanding staying in touch with what was going on that particular day. About almost halfway through my flying tour, I ended up going to Saigon as in a special office there because of some background knowledge that I had on the subject had to do with the Thailand and other places that had all of the special instruments and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest event there, of course, for me was Tet, and I lived off base at the time, and as I was talking a little earlier, I woke up and all this noise is going on with the gun shooting and whatnot, and I opened the windows and there's flares coming out of the airplanes and tracers going up at the airplanes, and I said, well, what do I do now? I started looking for, I had no weapon. I looked in my flying gear to see if I could find a knife just in case I needed to defend myself. It was gone. Someone had stolen it.
Wow.
So I turned on the radio to the America station, and it was nothing but music. And I had no idea what was going on. The next morning, as soon as it started to get daylight, I had cleaned up, put on my uniform. I rode a scooter to the base about a mile and a half away. As I was getting on the scooter, my landlady comes out and says, no go, no go. I said, why not? She said, VC all around. I said, nah. She says, come on roof. I went up on the roof with her, and there were two other guys, one that I had not seen in I don't know how long, a good friend, didn't even know he was there. They had guns, and we looked around. There's people shooting. There's people throwing hand grenades over a block away. And eventually, I convinced them, we need to get to the base. One had a Jeep. We drove to the base. They wouldn't let us drive on base. You might get in the line of fire. We walked to our offices and whatnot. I slept on my desk for a week. Then one of my guys that hadn't even gotten back to the base was due to leave the next day, and he called and asked if I could figure out some way to get him. So I borrowed, along with another guy that worked for me, borrowed a Jeep from General Jonesy. And
wait, I'm sorry, you borrowed a Jeep from a general?
Yes.
That's usually not a good career move, is it?
Well, he loaned it to
him. Oh, all right, okay.
He just didn't know where we were going.
Okay, fair enough.
I knew him. Jonesy Bolt was his name. He was a very fine general. And the other guy and I grabbed a couple of weapons. He had an automatic weapon, and I had my pistol, and he had a pistol. And we drove over, picked the guys up. Their eyes were so big waiting for us to get back. Took them to the flight line, and they got on their way. What we didn't know is we went through one of the worst parts of Saigon at that time for all of the people that were doing this shooting and whatnot. Right across from the street from me, practically, there were seven guys that were killed.
Oh, my gosh.
Trying to, when all of this started to happen. I've sat and watched at night the AC-47s firing on a perimeter of
and these are gunships, correct?
Yes. Okay. These were the older gunships at that time. And they literally protected Tonsonet Airport. There were places that they had cut through the bar, blown the barbed wire up where they come through. They just didn't come through soon enough. And I'm not going to tell you how many people that I was told, but it was a bunch.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that, because I want to make sure we touch on that. I mean, you saw a lot over the course of your life as a pilot. We're not going to be able to get to all of it today. Some of the stories in your book, Pete, though, really bring to the fore just the idea that this is a very dangerous business, even when people aren't shooting at you. Back in your day, and I think you call it the and I use quotation fingers, the old Air Force with the old guys and the old planes, you know, aerial refueling, something we almost take for, I don't have to do it, but it's maybe it wasn't as easy as it was back then or there's now. You didn't have GPS, you know, radio communication was not as good as it was, but I encourage folks to pick up a copy of the Friday Pilots and read all the stories, but look for that in Pete's chapter. We've got just a few minutes left, and I wanted to just take some time to talk about Hoot Gibson. That's something that you and I shared in common, both of us. I mean, he was your best friend. You were his best friend, as best we've heard. I got to know Hoot very briefly before he passed. Tell folks a little bit about Hoot Gibson, just what a great, great pilot and great American he was.
Well, he was a great pilot. He was a very fine person. He wasn't an argumentative person that got frustrated or using foul language or anything of this sort. He would look you in the eye and tell you what he thought, how it went. He was very compassionate. When my wife passed away, he literally took me under his arm and kept me on a path, if you will. And that was some 13 years ago. And when Hoot passed away, I received a call from his son and immediately, of course, tried to make any visit I could to his wife, who I've known, his sons and daughters. And, in fact, went out to their home on the X-9 ranch. Then, the next day, I guess, the family and I and another friend, Bill Hosmer, who has an article in the book as well, helped the family plan the funeral for Hoot. And as a result of that planning and whatnot, some of the other folks got together. I have to tell you, we had to find a special place for the funeral because of the number of people that showed up. I think it was around 1,200 people.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And we had a little special get-together down at the museum for him and several of the generals. As a matter of fact, General Fogelman came in and was kind of the spokesman for us at that exercise. He was well-known, well-thought-of, highly respected, not only by the military but the local people.
And I tell you, I interacted with him through my work at the chamber, and just a terrific guy. The third fighter ace in Korea, shot down five other aircraft, was flight lead, I think, for the Thunderbirds, the aerial demonstration team. Just a heck of a guy and a heck of a pilot. So I know Hoot's probably listening to us right now. I don't think we'll hear him call in today. Let's hope not. But, Pete, thanks so much for coming on. Folks, read the Friday Pilots. Get a copy of the book. $5 go to benefit the Fisher House. Pete, thank you so much for being here, and thanks for your service.
Thank you so much for having me, and I appreciate the opportunity being here. Thank you again.
There you go, folks. Another great show on the can. Listen, share the show on Facebook, American Warrior Daily Mail. Follow us on Twitter, at Warrior Radio TUC. Ladies and gentlemen, until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Thanks for tuning in today. Share the word.